12 minutes past seven. Now time for The Business with Conor Brophy.
Rachel, the Swiss-Irish company Arista saw a 6.5% increase in revenues from its food business to just under €800 million over the 3 months to the end of October. Arista, one of the largest producers of bread and other baked goods in Europe, managed that result despite currencies, most notably the dollar, moving against it to the tune of knocking almost 5% off revenue over the period. Staying with the food theme, McDonald's Restaurants Ireland falls back on the old corporate mantra of solid performance despite a challenging economic backdrop to describe its 2012 results. Turnover at McDonald's restaurants here was up 4.3% to just over €81 million, but that was due in part to the opening of two new outlets and the full year benefit of four McDonald's, which opened midway through 2011. Profit after tax rose from €11.3 million to €12.7 million. McDonald's has invested €20 million across its chain here over the past 3 years, it says, and it plans to invest a further €20 million over the next 3 years. As you heard in the headlines, Microsoft, which, like McDonald's, is one of Ireland's biggest foreign direct investors and employers, plans to add to its presence here. Its Irish Managing Director, Katrina Hallahan, will be with us at 10 to 8. Retail group Musgraves has denied a report in a Sunday newspaper that it was planning to launch a bank. In a statement, Musgrave, which operates Centra, Supervalue and Superquin, said it was in the early stages of looking at providing services such as insurance products to its customers, but it said these plans do not include personal or commercial loans. We would reiterate that we have no plans to launch a bank, it said. Irish law firms are feeling more positive about the economy, but two-thirds of them say their fee income is still under pressure, and a third have increased the amount of money set aside as a buffer against expected bad debts. Smith & Williamson has produced its annual survey of the sector, representing the views of 101 law firms, including 16 of the top 20 here. Paul Wise, its managing director, will talk us through the findings at 10 to 8, including a pretty grim assessment of the personal insolvency regime. In currency news, the euro trading at $1.35 and 83.5 pence sterling.
Thank you very much, Conor. In a moment, the breakthrough on Iran, has it a chance of working? It is 38 minutes past seven. It's time for It Says in the Papers from Clodagh Walsh.
So close to history, the pain of defeat. That headline from the Irish Daily Mail, next to a picture of Ireland rugby captain Paul O'Connell after yesterday's defeat against the All Blacks. On his hands and knees, head bowed, Ireland full back, Rob Kearney is on the front of the Irish Times, and the line, "Touch of black magic ruins Ireland's dream." The face of Brian O'Driscoll on the front of the Irish Examiner. Ireland's ball, the headline across the front of the Irish Daily Star, as it leads with the rugby story. And from the Irish Independent, above a picture of a very happy All Black squad. Kiwis prove mind is the real master. Pictures of players and fans alike, the twists and turns of the game, analysis, opinion, the whys and the where to now, all well and truly covered in all the papers this morning. And where to now for the Gard the whistleblower at the centre of the alleged abuse of the penalty point system. According to the lead in the Examiner, he's so angry at the lack of progress on the matter that he has offered to appear before the Dáil Public Accounts Committee. 19-year-old Thomas Flynn, whose picture is on the front of The Independent, was one of seven men who appeared and were charged at a special sitting of Cashel District Court in relation to an aggravated burglary in Tipperary. This story gets plenty of coverage in all the papers and is the lead for the Irish Daily Mirror. The front of The Mail, meanwhile, reports that CAB, the Criminal Assets Bureau, is tackling sophisticated criminals who are using car tracking devices and wireless cameras to target businesses. The Independent says that while the Revenue Commissioners are next year set to target homeowners who deliberately undervalued their house for property tax, so far there has been a higher than expected yield from the tax, as homeowners valued their houses above revenues advice, didn't try to evade the tax and didn't apply for a deferral. That paper's lead concerns what it calls the shock resignation of President Higgins' chief advisor just 18 months into the job, a story also carried in this morning's Times and Mail. It reports that just halfway through her contract, Mary Van Lieshout has left amid reports of tensions among the president's aides. For the Irish Times, the deal on Iran's nuclear programme is its front page story. It reports the deal was made possible by months of unprecedented secret meetings between US and Iranian officials. It says the Obama administration had asked journalists not to publish details they had uncovered of the secret diplomacy until the talks were over, for fear of derailing them. Elsewhere in that paper, Kitty Holland reports that new figures show that the number of people sleeping rough in Dublin has trebled since last year, creating increasing concern for the homeless population as winter closes in. And concern from a number of different groups over the planned erection of pylons makes for a double page feature in The Examiner. Conor Ryan writes that everyone has agreed the electricity network needs to be upgraded, but Airgrid's overland decision is proving contentious, while the Mail reports that Airgrid is considering extending the deadline for feedback on the plan following public pressure. The story of the couple arrested in London over allegations of slavery continues to be covered. The Irish Sun leads with it, concentrating on the youngest of the women believed to have been held captive, while the Times reports the couple in question have been linked to 13 other properties. And finally, the 1913 supplement inside The Independent today takes a look at what Ireland was like 100 years ago. It has a typical weekly budget for someone living in a tenement. Rent, 2 and 6. Fuel and light, 2 shillings. Bread, 4 shillings. Butter, 1 and 6. Potatoes, 1 shilling. In all, it comes to about 12 shillings and 11 pence. You wouldn't get far in it today.
Clodagh, thank you very much.
Just over a decade ago, the idea of sending in inspectors to check whether Iraq was telling the truth about weapons development in that country was tried, but then replaced by military action led by the US. Now, Iraq's neighbour, Iran, is involved in a process also involving inspectors, which will be sent in to check whether it is telling the truth about its nuclear plans. The deal was announced in Geneva at the weekend. Let's check on some of the reactions.
These are substantial limitations which will help prevent Iran from building a nuclear weapon. Simply put, they cut off Iran's most likely paths to a bomb.
Through implementing this agreement, the regime of sanctions will be broken whether others like it or not. Cracks have been made in the sanctions regime.
What was concluded in Geneva is not a historic agreement. It's a historic mistake.
And that's Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Israel, it should be pointed out, was not involved in those talks at Geneva. And before him, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani and, of course, President Barack Obama. We're joined on the line from London to assess what's been agreed. And so far it's been agreed, and we should point out this is part of a 6-month agreement. It is an interim deal with the hope that it will lead to something more permanent. Is Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Good morning and thanks for taking the call.
Good morning.
First of all, what has been agreed? How substantial is it?
It's very substantial. It is only a 6-month deal, as you say, but it's the most significant curb on Iran's nuclear program for 10 years since the dispute began. What it does is, it doesn't completely freeze Iran's nuclear program, but it freezes all the most important parts. Particularly, Iran will not have any more enriched uranium at the end of the agreement than it does at the beginning. And it actually eliminates some of the most dangerous parts of Iran's program, such as enrichment to 20%, which is 9/10 of the way to weapons grade. In addition to all of this, it has upgraded inspections. So Iran, the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, can now inspect Iran on a daily basis. It already is inspecting Iran, but it can do so even more. And in return, Iran gets under $6 billion worth of sanctions relief, which I should point out is a pretty small fraction of what it's losing in the oil and banking sanctions every month, which are not being removed. So most of the pressure is remaining on Iran. So all in all, this is a pretty significant deal for the Western powers.
What's in it for Iran?
Well, apart from the sanctions relief that I mentioned, which is modest for now, although it will help ease Iran's foreign exchange problems, its access to foreign exchange reserves, it's also the promise that its civilian nuclear program will be recognized at the end of this process. And one of the most important aspects of this deal is that it says in writing, at the end of this entire deal, Iran will have, and I quote, a mutually defined enrichment program. That is really significant because for a long time, the Western powers have said Iran is not allowed enrichment. The UN Security Council has said it must stop enrichment. This deal says it will be allowed that, although under strict curbs. So Iran has received recognition of what it claims is its right to enrich, a hugely symbolic domestic political point. The West can say, no, we haven't given you a right, but we will tolerate it. So we've artfully crafted language that bridges that most significant point of contention.
Two obvious dangers. One we've heard already from Mr. Netanyahu, and Israel reserving the right to act militarily, which they would do anyway. But Whatever about that, there is, aren't there political problems ahead in Congress or potential problems in Washington with Congress not at all convinced, even among Democrats, the president's supporters, that this is the way to go?
Absolutely. There is bipartisan opposition in many quarters. I mean, some powerful senators have said this is a good deal. Dianne Feinstein, who's a key Senate intelligence chair, has said this is a good deal. But you're absolutely right. I think the risk of Congress trying to push through with sanctions is a serious one, particularly because the deal says no new sanctions will be introduced. So the U.S. would be breaking its word to Iran if that occurred. Now, remember, the president can veto new bills coming through Congress with sanctions, but the Houses of Congress can override his veto if there's a two-thirds majority in Congress. So there is always that risk. I don't think the risk is really coming from Israel here. Israel probably cannot now use military force. What it could do, perhaps, is resume its covert action, for example, assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists or sabotage against Iranian nuclear facilities, including cyber attacks. And I think that would also severely complicate Iranian goodwill if that were to occur.
Finally, and briefly, if you could, Do we detect from the way you're talking about this that this is not a good day's work, because it appears now that there were secret contacts going on between the Americans, according to an AP report, and the Iranians for a long time before this, but that the result, insofar as it goes, is pretty positive?
It's extremely positive. I mean, this is my own opinion. I think it's objectively undeniable. Iran has been put further from a nuclear weapon at pretty minimal cost, and you have to build on this. In 6 months, you now have to succeed this with a final status deal, which is going to be very, very hard indeed. But look, the alternative here was Iran's nuclear program growing and growing, and within the next 6 months, it would have reached dangerous levels. So I think this is an exceptional deal, modest in its achievement for now, but potentially the basis for something absolutely historic.
Shashank Joshi, thank you very much for talking to us.
It's many months now since the last American ambassador to Ireland, Dan Rooney, returned to the United States. Well, finally, a Missouri businessman, Tom Carnahan, is being tipped to take up residence in the Phoenix Park. Simon Carswell, who's the Irish Times correspondent in Washington, has been telling me about Mr. Carnahan. But first, why the delay?
Well, it's been a delay of almost a year. The longest delay of that kind was some time ago, back in the 30s, that we'd seen, haven't seen a U.S. ambassador appointed. The reason is said to be to do with the fact that a number of candidates have already gone through the vetting process and either haven't made it through or they've withdrawn their names. And given the climate at the moment in Washington, the White House wants to make sure that there are no skeletons in any closets, and making sure that the next U.S. ambassador can be confirmed by the Senate and there's no issues arising. So the White House clearly wants to make sure all the checks are done, all the FBI checks and financial checks that are required for the appointment of ambassadors. So that's one of the reasons why it has taken so long for them to pick an ambassador.
A new name has emerged. Who is Tom Carnahan?
Tom Carnahan is a Missouri businessman. He's a former lawyer. He lives in St. Louis. He comes from a well-connected political family. He died in the wool Democrats, based in the U.S. Midwest. He would have very strong ties with President Obama. His father, Mel, was a governor of Missouri, and he ran for the Senate, but he died in a plane crash in 2000, and his wife, Jean, took the seat. Tom Carnahan's brother, Russ, was a congressman, and his sister has served as Secretary of State in Missouri, and she also ran unsuccessfully for the Senate in 2010. So very strong political ties to the Democrats and to the Obama administration.
He's also quite young. He's only 44. Nowadays, what does the U.S. ambassador to Ireland do?
Well, for the most part, it would be making sure relations are strong with the two between the two countries. And one of the main focuses that would be going on between the two countries would be the focus on economic ties, given the crash in Ireland and the recovery. And Carnahan's business background would equip him well and make him a suitable candidate at that end, particularly when Ireland is so reliant on foreign direct investment in the U.S. and exports to the U.S. He's a strong business background. He'd know the Irish business scene well. He set up a company called Wind Capital, which built wind farms in the U.S. Midwest. And that company was sold to the Irish investment group, NTR, which specialized in renewable energy. So he'd be very familiar with the Irish business scene. He had previously been a lawyer, and he left He left his law practice in 2005 to set up that business. One of the areas that will be a blind spot for Carnahan would be Northern Ireland. And that would be now less of a foreign policy issue than it once was for US ambassadors. But he would have a fairly strong background in international relations. He studied it in Missouri and a year in Cambridge. So, again, this would be an area that would stand him well to learn more about Northern Ireland. He's also worked as an observer in elections in Hungary, Cambodia and in El Salvador as well.
And that was Simon Carswell of the Irish Times in Washington.
As police in London continue in their investigation of how three women were allegedly held captive for 30 years in the city, a lawyer who's the leading specialist in slavery prosecutions has said there are likely to be very serious difficulties in prosecuting the case. She's Caroline Haughey, who received her legal training, by the way, in Trinity College in Dublin, and is fairly familiar with Irish law on this as well. I asked her earlier this morning, what are the difficulties involved in prosecuting this kind of case?
What I'm saying is that it will be very difficult to prosecute the entire ambit of the criminality. We're dealing with a 30-year span of criminality. We can certainly prosecute what's happened in the last 3 years under the Slavery Act, which is for us as the Coroner's Act, Section 71. That's not a problem. Conduct predating that could be challenging. You would have to look at, for example, trafficking within the UK. So would you be able to reflect the defendants moving the victims from one location to another and continuing the exploitation? If you did, you could look at doing trafficking within the United Kingdom. But if they haven't left the country, again, you're in challenging of bringing them into the United Kingdom, because that's one of the prerequisites for the earlier trafficking legislation. So false imprisonment, to me, is the starting point to reflect 30 years of criminality. However, on reflection, once a jury see where you're starting from, you'd almost want to prosecute this in reverse. So start with the recent offending and move backwards. Then I think you'd have a greater chance of achieving a successful prosecution.
Does that mean that conviction would be, in this alleged case, possible, in your view?
Oh, yes. Yes, it is possible. Every case is a challenge. We have a very, quite properly, as we have in Ireland, we have in England and Wales, very high standard of proof and a burden of proof, and persuading a jury, the burden being on the Crown or on the prosecution, is very high. There is a chance of success, but it depends on the compellability, or how compelling the victims are and how credible they are.
And you can think of all kinds of reasons why that there might be a problem there.
Well, of course it will be. You're dealing with victims who, before they've even started being abused in this criminal sense, were vulnerable in the first place. That's in my experience of every case that I have done, whether it be human trafficking or trafficking for sexual services. The victims have always been damaged from the outset. That's specifically why they are targeted. And thus, it will make it very difficult for anyone, any advocate prosecuting this case, and indeed the officers investigating it, to extract from the victims complaints that will stand up to scrutiny by defence counsel. We, in Ireland and in England and Wales, work in an adversarial justice system, and they will be scrutinised. And weaknesses, failings, inconsistencies, things that don't quite add up, will be challenged. And if it doesn't meet the standard, then the reality is a jury will be in a difficult position to convict. It will be the obligation and the duties of the officers to ensure, together with counsel and CPS lawyer, that their case is as strong as it can possibly be.
Briefly, are you spelling out a legal reality, or are you spelling out a legal problem to which there could be an answer in legislation?
Well, it's not so much a legislative problem. It is a practical problem faced by those of us who prosecute these cases. They are not like other cases. It's not like a rape case where he said, she said, and you try, if you can, to get supporting evidence. In cases such as these, human trafficking, slavery, sex trafficking, it is vital to obtain material that supports the credibility of your complainant.
And that's Caroline Haughey, lawyer in London, speaking to me earlier. It's 25 minutes to 8 o'clock. Unfortunately, it's time for the sports news. Darren Frahill, good morning. Do we have to talk about this?
I'm afraid so, Cathal. My colleague in the business section of the RTÉ newsroom was telling me about a tweet that David Walsh sent out yesterday. And I'm not sure it's suitable for this hour of the morning, but he reckoned he wished he died at halftime and he wouldn't have had to see what happened at the end.
It's only a game.
One of those ones, though, that we will be left wondering, you know, what if Ireland's still chasing their first win over New Zealand following a dramatic 24-22 defeat against the All Blacks. Now, first half tries from Conor Murray, Rory Best and Rob Kearney meant the Irish had a lead of 22-17 entering the closing stages. We all thought we'd done it, but then Ryan Crotty's try at the death and then Aaron Cruden's conversion, which had to be retaken, ended Irish hopes of a first win over New Zealand in over 100 years. Heartbreak then for the Irish, and Gary Moore spoke to some of the key men. In a moment, Gordon Darcy and Rob Kearney, but first, here are the thoughts of skipper Paul O'Connell.
It's very disappointing, obviously, but it is what it is. You know, you get chances to put these teams away, you have to take them. They're not 14 out of 14 this season for no reason. You know, when they're under the cosh, they stay calm and they're able to produce the goods. And you know, up until whatever it was 79-15, we'd done all the stuff right that we needed to do. And you know, we just give them a sniff. Then they got over for a try, and it's testament to their character. And it's obviously very disappointing for us.
As you know, about everybody else, was my worst moment in sports so far.
Well, that says a lot.
Yeah, it's been a long career, and that one's, yeah, it's been so many great highs in rugby and everything like that, but this is really the lowest low.
Yeah, absolutely. God, I haven't had a defeat like that in my career to date. But that sport, you never get what you deserve sometimes, and you know, luck is often against you when maybe you deserve a little bit. But yeah, that's got to be the worst I've had in a long, long time.
Did you at any point let yourselves think we've got them, or we could beat them here, or we have them here?
All day we were thinking that. There was a great atmosphere in the camp. I'll be honest with you, at 79 minutes and 30 seconds when we were in their half and we had the ball, I was pretty sure we were going to win it. But it just shows you can never switch off. Final whistle is final whistle, and it's never over until that final whistle goes, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, so remarkable honesty there from a number of the more experienced Irish players. We're joined on the line by former Irish international and RTÉ analyst Tony Ward. Tony, will we ever get a better chance to beat New Zealand than we did yesterday?
I don't think so, but as Rob said there, you know, it's the beauty of sport and it's the cruelty of sport. But our emotions are all over the place, and we're just hearing how the players will feel, and it's going to get harder for them. And yet, having said all that, Darren, like, turn the clock back a week, and we're in a far better place today. And I know it's easy for me to say that because I'm sitting in the stand watching it. It's really tough on the players, I can assure you. Mm. Really, really tough to be within touching distance of history, because that's how close it was.
Sure. The New Zealand coach, Steve Hansen, felt that Ireland lacked the self-belief to get the job done. Would you agree with him?
It's a difficult one, that. They certainly have the self-belief, there's no doubt about that, when you're comparing them. I have to say, I felt in the final minutes that, you know, we were back to, do you remember the Munster game against Biarritz all those years ago in the Heineken Cup when we won it and we closed the game out because there were certain key personnel still involved? And yet when that penalty was turned over, you just fear the worst. And someone suggested to me afterwards that, you know, because they were going for this record of the 14th win, that's why they kept at it right up to the, whatever it was, I don't know, was it a minute and a half into injury time? I don't believe that. I think it's a mentality, it's a rugby psyche, it's a mental toughness, it's something that they've built up over 130 odd years. We haven't got that at the moment. And that's why it would have been such a huge psychological barrier, Darren, if we had got over it yesterday. Alas, it wasn't to be.
Finally and briefly, if you don't mind, Tony, was this performance a once-off, or can we build on this?
Well, that's the key. I mean, the bar has now been raised. They've shown what they're capable of doing, and that's where we've got to kick on now going into the Six Nations. But I think we're in a good place to do it. We've got the confidence, obviously, from yesterday's game. The experience is there. Joe is now in place. So look, onward and upward, and let's all look forward to a really exciting 2014 Six Nations Championship.
Let's hope you're right. Tony Ward, thanks as always for taking the call. Jimmy Coppard's late penalty saw Leinster claim a narrow 21 20 victory over Treviso in the Pro 12. Castlebar Mitchells are the new AIB Connacht football champions. They beat the All-Ireland champions St Bridget's after extra time. Here's their midfielder, Barry Moran.
We're absolutely delighted. You know, it's been 20 years since we won our first county and 20 years, as you said, since we won the Connacht final. But we're just delighted we got through today. Slogged it out. Really, really tough game. Extra time, the whole lap, but we came through it, thank God.
In Leinster, Port Laois will play St Vincent's in this year's decider following wins over Moorfield and Summerhill. Now, Pearsig are the Munster hurling champions. They had a 4-14-8 victory over Six Mile Bridge. Cardiff City scored a late goal to draw 2-2 with Manchester United in the English Premier League. Manchester City are fourth in the standings after a 6-0 victory over Tottenham. Now, 25-1 shot, Cootamundra won the Ladbrokes Troytown Handicap Chase at Navan. The John Berry trained 10-year-old took the honours with Robbie Mourne on board.
It was great for him. He's threatened to win in a big one all the time, you know, and he, thanks be to God, he's won one now. Yeah, we're down in Wexford, yeah, near the coast, sunny southeast. We'd have only about 15 in, you know, we're small outfits, so it was a great job. It'll be massive celebrations, a couple of days, I'd say.
Now, the Irish cricket team qualified for the 2014-2020 World Cup following an 85-run victory over Hong Kong. Jason Day took the individual honours as Australia won the World Cup of Golf. Ireland finished in 11th place. And finally, Red Bull's Sebastian Vettel brought the F1 season to a close with a 9th consecutive win at the Brazilian Grand Prix. Lots more sport to come at 8:35. We'll be joined live by the Irish coach, Joe Schmidt.
Thank you very much, Darren. 19 minutes to 8. The local and European elections are now just 6 months away, and after a string of poor opinion polls, the government parties will be hoping that change is afoot. Yesterday's Red Sea survey for the Sunday Business Post indicated that more than half of the country's voters approve of the way the government plans to exit the bailout. The poll also contained some rare good news for Labour, with the party climbing 3 points. Pat Leahy, the political editor of the Sunday Business Post, is on the line. Good morning. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, Rachel.
Before we talk about these figures, what are they?
Yeah, yesterday's figures were 29% for Fine Gael, 12% for Labour, 22% for Fianna Fáil, 15% for Sinn Féin, and 22% for the Independents. The most significant move in all that, as you say, is for Labour, up by 3 points from a month ago, and that is, you know, to put it in context, the poll we had a month ago was Labour's worst poll for donkey's years since about 2008-2007. So, you know, I think it's important always to look a bit beyond the numbers. While the numbers are interesting in themselves, what's important is to look for the trend. And what this suggests, allied to some of the other data in the poll, is that there is a possible way back for Labour. And that's the first time we've seen that in this whole series.
Now, more than half of those surveyed approved of how the government is leading the country from the bailout. But at the same time, almost three quarters of voters say, enough, time to ease up on the austerity.
Yeah, the latter figure isn't really surprising. Austerity is never going to be popular, and we've seen that throughout a whole range of surveys. But what I think yesterday's poll offers evidence for, when more than half of voters gave the government credit for exiting the bailout, allied to the continuing support for the kind of pro-bailout parties, is there is a fairly sizable majority, I think, of people who don't like austerity but think it or some version of it is probably necessary. And that really is the base of support into which government, the government parties can look for growth.
When the public is reminded of the last government, i.e. when the bailout is discussed, Fianna Fáil tends to suffer. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously, you know, when you look at where they were at the time of the last election, Fianna Fáil's recovery, when they got 17% of first preference votes, their worst performance in an election by a country mile. Since then, Fianna Fáil's resurgence has been remarkable, But what we've seen, and we saw this with the Anglo tapes at the beginning of the summer, and we see it a little bit again in this poll, is that when there is a focus on the performance of the last government and on the collapse of the last government and the bailout and all of that, that tends to hit Fianna Fáil support. So I think what you'll see, especially with the government's banking inquiry beginning to take shape in the new year, is you will see the government parties trying to focus on the past. In a way, that's hardly surprising, nor is it surprising that people haven't entirely forgotten Fianna Fáil's performance, at the particularly at the end of the last government.
Talking about the future, possibly, something interesting in the small print yesterday, a sizeable increase in support for independence in Dublin.
Yeah, we've seen this now in the last two polls that that we've conducted. Now, obviously, when you begin to look inside the data in the poll, you kind of have to look at it over a few polls to let your trends firm up. But what we've seen is fairly strong independent support, which has been a feature of all these polls, really, since this government became unpopular in the year or so after it first took office. But we see a slightly different character to the independent support, particularly in Dublin. And, you know, we don't ask specifically about voting intention about the Reform Alliance, the group of ex-Fine Gael TDs, because we don't know yet if they will form a new party and contest the election in that guise. But I think there is some evidence there to suggest that there is a base of support for them.
Pat, thanks indeed for that. Pat Leahy there, who's the political editor of the Sunday Business Post. It's 14 minutes to 8.
We heard earlier in the programme about hopes for progress on Iran in the Middle East, but there is, of course, another conflict going on about which there is no apparent sign yet of any move towards a resolution or bringing that conflict to an end. That conflict is, of course, Syria, where it is estimated, and it is only an estimate, but nobody disagrees, that at least 100,000 people have been killed since that civil war began. Well, the Oxford Research Group, which pioneers alternatives to violence, has been researching one particular aspect of the Syrian conflict, and it shows that, according to their estimates, more than 11,000 children, in other words, about 1 in 10, at least, of those killed in the Syrian civil war, have been children. We're joined by the co-author of the Oxford Research Group's report, Hamid Dardagan. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Now, how did you go about getting the evidence to be able to say that 11,000 children have been killed?
Well, we took a closer look at the databases that have basically been providing the estimates of the kind that you've just mentioned of 100,000 killed. In a sense, these are not estimates. These are lists of people killed. Each of the sources, they're based in Syria, has a different level of coverage. So you sort of need to look at them all together to get as full a picture as possible. And that's where these estimates, which are now rising well above 100,000, come from. But we wanted to see what these figures really represent. I mean, often we hear statistics and one's eyes just glaze over. And we want to find out what they actually break down into. I mean, for example, most particularly, what proportion of them are children? And those children that have been killed, we wanted to find out how they've been killed. It's a little bit like your previous guest was talking about. It's not just the numbers, but the trends within them that are important. And we did something similar to that.
In terms of male and female, what's the breakdown?
Well, we found that roughly twice as many boys have been killed as girls. Partly that's because boys are targeted more. Now, overall, the deaths have been due largely from explosive weapons. Roughly 7 out of 10 children killed were killed by bombing, aerial bombardments, and artillery fire and shelling and so on. So that accounted for most deaths, and those are indiscriminate killers. They just roughly kill, you know, when used in populated areas, they kill civilians, including children, indiscriminately. But what we also found was that out of the 1 in 4 child deaths that were due to small arms fire, there was clear evidence of targeting. That's to say, we had nearly 400 children who had been killed by snipers, which is obviously a very targeting kind of a weapon. And we had nearly 800 killed by summary executions, field executions, that is, children killed point blank and in massacres and so on.
Which is horrendous. But is it fair to say the broad thrust of your research is that if you have a civil war as fierce as Syria's, then children get in the way and come in harm's way and suffer as a result in large numbers, 11,000 according to your estimates?
Yes. Yes, it is to be expected, and particularly so when you see the kind of devastation wreaked on ordinary neighborhoods. I mean, we're talking about children killed where they live, where they play. So it's not, in a sense, of course, one could just predict that, but it's quite a different thing to actually discover whether that's the case. And I think what we've managed to do here is to show just the scale of child deaths in the country. I mean, I think the impression often is that, you know, it's government forces versus rebel forces, and yes, indeed it is that, but also point in some ways of focusing on children was to show just how pervasive the war is for ordinary civilians. I mean, if there are this many children being killed, you can imagine just how pervasive it is, how women and elderly and others, you know, men who are not part of the fighting are also being killed.
Hamid Dardigan, thank you very much. 8 minutes to 8, business from Connor.
Cahill, Microsoft is looking for more software developers at its Microsoft Office and Applications, Media and Publishing groups in Ireland. It's also seeking a further 65 staff across a range of other functions. Microsoft Ireland Managing Director Katrina Hallahan is with us now in studio. Katrina, what sort of software will these new recruits be developing?
I think there's two main areas that they're going to be focused on. One group will be in our Office division, which is working on a lot of our new subscription program for online services like Office 365. And the other is in our Applications, Media and Publishing group, where we're focusing on sports experiences across different devices now, whether that's mobile phone or your tablet or your PC.
Is there a lot of competition within Microsoft for where these types of functions are located, and how does Ireland manage to grab them?
Well, we have a number of development centres across the globe. I think the unique proposition for Ireland is the fact that we don't just have a development centre, we have a data centre, we have an operations centre, we sales marketing. So the leadership team here focus very much on how do we grow value for the company here, how do we continue to look at investments and innovating and evolving the roles that we have here in Ireland. So we've been very successful in that.
We've seen a lot of coverage of the brand over the past week with the launch of the new Xbox One games console. Is there much of a spin-off benefit to Ireland from that launch?
Well, we have a gaming development team here, but we also have our supply chain organisation that supports Europe, Middle East and Africa, who are very busy at the moment getting all those Xbox Ones out. And then we were picked as one of the launch markets as well for Xbox One. Not every market is getting involved in the launch, so it's very exciting for us.
Katrina Hallahan, thank you. Irish law firms are feeling more bullish than they were a year ago, according to an annual survey of the sector published by professional services firm Smith & Williamson, but many of them still report pressure on fees and concerns about bad debts. Paul Wise is Managing Director of Smith & Williamson Ireland. Paul, when we talk about the confidence within the sector, it does seem as if there's still pressures in there.
There are pressures in there, but I think people are happier that they're in a better place than they were 12 months ago. You know, the pressures that you're talking about with bad debts increasing in about 34% of firms, billing rates dropping in about 36% of firms. You know, that's one side of the coin, but firms are trying to increase their activities, their markets, their services, and 53% of firms have seen their revenues increase, 45% have seen profits increase.
You've spoken to, I think, 101 different law firms across the country, including 16 of the top 20. One of the responses that leaps out is the feeling about the personal insolvency regime. Only 11% of them believe it will actually address the issues of people with debt problems. They seem to be pretty gloomy about it.
Yeah, I think the major concern there is the power of the bank veto, more so than anything else. And it's an aspect that has proven itself in reality in that the number of certificates that have issued, I think it's only about 3 so far. So this avalanche of expectation has not materialised itself.
and 95% of them saying that the UK bankruptcy regime is an ultimate resort better than what we have here.
Yeah, I think the UK bankruptcy regime is a well-oiled machine at this stage, and it has practice and case law to back it, and people can exit the process after the 12-month period as against the three-year process here. So I think the legal sector feels it's still probably a better option.
Paul Wise, Managing Director of Smith & Williamson Ireland, thank you. In currency news, finally, for now, the euro trading at $1.35 and 83.5 pence sterling.
Siobhan Ryan of Metairn, good morning.
Good morning. Well, the current dry spell is going to stay with us well into the coming week, with an intense area of high pressure continuing to dominate. This anticyclone or blocking high will keep Atlantic rain belts at bay, so our weather continuing in the same vein, largely dry, calm and settled. That said, it will be rather cool and overall quite cloudy, but pleasant enough where autumn sunshine manages to break through. And now for some detail. It'll be generally dry and calm, but rather cloudy or overcast today, with patchy mist, drizzle and fog, mainly near west and northwest coasts. Some autumn sunshine possibly breaking through later in the day, but sunshine will be limited and quite cool, with highest temperatures of 6 to 9 degrees. Stay mostly dry and calm tonight under broken cloud, but quite cold, lowest temperatures of minus 2 to plus 3 degrees, values lowest over Munster and Leinster, with a sharp frost possible. Really it all hinges on cloud. So a very frosty start in parts to tomorrow, another cool day, but likely to be a little bit brighter overall, and stay mainly dry and calm, with highest temperatures on a par with today, ranging 6 to 9 degrees. Dry and calm too for Wednesday and Thursday, with rather cloudy skies, but at least frost should be somewhat less of a threat, with temperatures a little higher too. And by Friday, likely to be a little bit breezier now, with a mix of cloud and sunny spells, scattered outbreaks of rain too, mainly affecting the north and northwest. Finally today in brief, generally dry and calm, but overall quite dull, cool, with highest temperatures of 6 to 9 degrees. That's your forecast. A very good morning.